The strange, and I would say ironic thing about health food is that people outside the very small counterculture suddenly became interested in it. Dannon ran these wonderful ads with 100-year-old Bulgarians and the benefits of live cultures. And people began to shop at these health food stores. And they did so for essentially the same reasons as the hippies. You know, they were afraid of processed and artificial food.
Welcome back to Food, a Cultural Culinary History, a podcast brought to you by The Great Courses Plus. I'm Jason Smigel, and like you, I'm a lifelong learner. I've been listening to The Great Courses for over 14 years, and I'm excited to be sharing this great course as a podcast with you. This podcast is hosted by Ken Albala, who's professor of history and chair of food studies at the University of the Pacific. He's also the author of Ken Albala's Food Rant, a highly popular blog for people who love food. Episode 34, Counterculture, From Hippies to Foodies. In today's podcast, we're going to explore the backlash against processed food in the late 20th century. We'll see the rise of the health food movement and new dietary ideologies. And we'll see how this ushers in a vibrant new era in food that creates things like artisan food producers, slow food culture, and farmers markets. As always, if you're interested in trying any of Ken's recipes and food experiments, or even seeing photos and illustrations of the concepts that Ken mentions in this podcast, you can find supporting materials for this podcast at thegreatcoursesdaily.com.
In the latter half of the 20th century, a variety of individuals and movements challenged the hegemony of the modern industrial food system. That challenge came from a wide variety of angles: gastronomic, ethical, environmental, and in this lecture, we'll take a look at them all. We'll also look at farmers' markets, sustainable agriculture, rescuing traditional foods and production methods, and what is generally known as health food. Ironically, these very health foods were also eventually mass-produced by the food industry, and that's part of the story. There had been protests against the food industry and modern eating practices long before the events that I'll discuss today. The most important of these was a second health food movement in the 60s and 70s, much like the one in the early 19th century, except this one did not originate among wealthy people visiting fashionable spas and sanatoriums, but was really one facet of a wider counterculture rebellion of this in the 60s and 70s, and went hand in hand with, for lack of a better term, hippies and flower power and free love and psychedelic music and long hair and anti-war protests. And they were basically saying that everything about the way most Americans live is wrong, including and especially their food. And it often had a political angle as well. As one protester put it, flour, sugar, and rice all bleached to match the bleached out mentality of white supremacy. So this was a political counterculture as well as a counter cuisine. They had many cogent complaints about the American diet. They believed that what most Americans eat is unhealthy. They believed that farming practices pollute the earth. They believed that technologically enhanced, mass-produced food is aesthetically bankrupt. So they looked to simpler foods, ones that don't exploit animals. And in fact, vegetarianism was a major trend within this movement. And they also sought to eat local foods grown sustainably and in season and prepared by human hands and shared, sometimes communally. In fact, the time spent to prepare food and for other people was seen as invaluable. The environmental concern about food went mainstream with the publication of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring in 1962. It made people realize that a nice, shiny red apple, simply because it looks good, doesn't necessarily mean it's good for you, especially when laced with pesticides like DDT that not only harm us but prevent birds' eggs from forming properly. It kills animals and basically disrupts the whole ecosystem, which ultimately harms us because those toxins sort of make their way up the food chain. And they harm us whether we care about birds and bees or not. And of course, we do need bees. They pollinate flowers. Carson was also, to her credit, a legitimate scientist. So for the first time, a scientist was saying, maybe everything we're doing is not for the best. Maybe you shouldn't always trust what experts say is perfectly safe, because sometimes they are either wrong, and that's the nature of science, to constantly revise, or they do things for profit rather than human welfare. And of course, she was a superb writer as well, so people read her book. Let me read you one brief passage, which I think will resonate nicely with the themes throughout this course. Under primitive agricultural conditions, the farmer had few insect problems. These arose with the intensification of agriculture, the devotion of immense acreages to a single crop. Such a system set the stage for explosive increases in specific insect populations. Single crop farming does not take advantage of the principles by which nature works. Nature has introduced great variety into the landscape, but man has displayed a passion for simplifying it. Thus, he undoes the built-in checks and balances by which nature holds the species within bounds. In other words, the insect problems are actually our fault. The answer is not to spray more chemicals, but to diversify crops and let natural predators take care of the insects. For Carson, this was not just a scientific matter, but a moral one. For example, when discussing all the animals killed needlessly by pesticides, she said this: "By acquiescing in an act that can cause such suffering to a living creature, who among us is not diminished as a human being?" In sum, she was saying that we should simply return to simpler ways of farming, more in harmony with nature, rather than torturing it to get what we want. This message resonated very nicely with health food movement that wanted to return to an older, simpler, and what they thought were healthier ways of life by growing and eating so-called natural foods. And it is essentially the same message we heard from Jean-Jacques Rousseau 2 centuries earlier. The idea is that progress has made us sick, artificial, and unfree. Natural food here meant food grown without chemical fertilizers or pesticides, without artificial preservatives or additives, without artificial coloring, and with the minimum processing possible. Macrobiotic diets also became a trendy approach to eating only whole foods, and it actually has its origins much earlier in 19th century Japan. And in one version, which is not really so healthy, it involves a progressive narrowing of foods until finally you live mostly on brown rice. Veganism was also something new, not using any animal products whatsoever, not butter, not eggs, not even honey, because that exploits the animals for the use of man. The British Vegan Society was founded in 1944, an American Vegan Society followed in 1960, and a World Vegan Day has been celebrated on November 1st since 1994. Another very important book was Diet for a Small Planet. That's 1971, written by Francis Moore Lappé. And it made essentially the same argument that ancient Greco-Roman Plutarch made, but in far more explicit terms. She argued, if the population continues to grow, which of course it has, then eating meat is a remarkably inefficient way of using land because you need several acres to support a cow, and the same land planted with grains provides many more calories. So more people could be fed on a vegetable diet, which the author saw as a solution to feeding poverty-stricken people around the globe. Instead of just feeding the wealthiest countries beef, everyone could eat better if we switched to being vegetarians. Perhaps coincidentally, the health food movement also looked to time-tested ancient eating practices of non-European peoples. They looked to Asia predominantly, hence the introduction of tofu and bean sprouts. The vogue of Buddhism helped that. And they also looked to India to a certain extent. Think of the popularity of the Hare Krishna movement in this country, which started in 1966. But also, and perhaps most importantly, the health food movement looked to whole grain flours, even ancient species like spelt and kamut. They're the relatives of wheat, and amaranth and quinoa, those ancient American grains we saw earlier in the course. It was also the health food movement that introduced hummus and pita bread and yogurt, part of what was then coined as the Mediterranean diet. It's the same Ansel Keys, the same person who created those U.S. government K-rations for World War II. He coined that idea. Note, all of these are traditional ancient foods, and though, even though they're not necessarily those of the people themselves, but they're ancient to someone on Earth. The strange, and I would say ironic thing about health food is that people outside the very small counterculture suddenly became interested in it. Dannon ran these wonderful ads with 100-year-old Bulgarians and the benefits of live cultures. And people began to shop at these health food stores. And they did so for essentially the same reasons as the hippies. You know, they were afraid of processed and artificial food. But where there's money to be made, someone will move in with a big scheme, invest a lot of cash, and, like a good capitalist, eventually clean up. So, ironically, the major food manufacturers start selling their own mass-produced brands of things like pita bread and tofu and pure peanut butter and yogurt and whole wheat bread. In other words, these foods go mainstream, ironically, and they capitalized on the fad for things that were all natural, which was, you know, you'd see it on products in every major grocery store across the country by the late 70s. There's actually a classic book on this topic by Warren Belasco. It's called Appetite for Change. Even the health food stores themselves changed. Instead of selling fresh produce and locally raised foods, they started selling things that came in packages, mass-produced cereals, all-natural corn chips, Eden Foods soy milk, and, you know, big-brand 12-grain muffins. In other words, they became scarcely different than food industry products themselves, except that they may have been, I don't know, lower in fat or only used natural ingredients, or they were specifically vegetarian, but they're still mass-produced. And they are also highly processed and controlled by large corporations, not necessarily interested in healthy food. They're still shipped all around the country. They still use ingredients grown abroad and harvested by laborers, sometimes paid deplorable wages and terrible conditions. And I think the entire social consciousness side of the health food movement fell by the wayside. This was even sometimes done by the small hippie producers themselves, who kind of sold out. I think Earthbound Farm, you know, the salad in a bag, that's maybe the best example of this. Other people spawned by this generation held true to the original idea of eating what we would now call organic foods, grown locally, eaten at the peak of freshness, and cooked in traditional ways. And without a doubt, the best example of this whole generation is Alice Waters. Her restaurant Chez Panisse opened in Berkeley in 1971. And it's anything but simple food, and it's definitely not vegetarian. But I think she is probably the most obvious connection between that hippie generation and what we should call today the foodie generation. She's also been one of the most influential professional chefs in the country in the past few decades. Restaurants, or at least very good ones, as a rule, think of this, never serve anything but fresh ingredients now. Some buy directly from local farms, or they buy artisanal cheeses directly from the makers, things like that. I think she was very influential in. And a lot of professional chefs now trained in the kitchens at Chez Panisse. You may know Mark Miller. He's one who popularized Southwest cuisine. A similar interest in fresh, local, and artisanal cooking actually occurred in France also. Well, Paul Bocuse in Lyon, the Trois Gros brothers near Dijon. And there was a new focus on provincial cooking, making traditional local recipes, using ingredients that were raised locally. And I think this is all really ultimately in reaction to the grand restaurant cuisine of Escoffier that would use ingredients no matter where they came from. You might also say that nouvelle cuisine, the latest iteration of it, was at first a way to simplify and streamline French cooking by getting rid of all those heavy, starchy, butter and roux-laden sauces, the reduced stocks, and instead using undercooked vegetables, bright, citrusy sauces, and an aesthetic that I think to a great extent is borrowed from Japan, especially when you think about presentation. Food was, once again, meant to taste like itself, using fresh, local ingredients. And of course, everyone complained that the portions were so tiny, but I would argue that eventually it became very complex and even obscure, especially if you think of the sort of towering food in the 1980s. But this approach definitely did have a lasting impact on gastronomy in general.
If you're enjoying this podcast and want more of the same, you can find hundreds of audio courses on all sorts of topics, all taught by brilliant professors like Ken Albala, at thegreatcoursesplus.com/podcasts, the new audio and video streaming site from The Great Courses, the leader in lifelong learning, featuring in-depth courses on subjects ranging from algebra, great battles of history, engineering, money and banking, Mozart's chamber music, you name it. At The Great Courses Plus, you can learn everything about anything.
The other influential individual is the poet, farmer, and political activist Wendell Berry, who also really bridged this period to the present. He was another outspoken critic of fast food and the way that it partnered with huge agribusiness to homogenize the food supply, push out small farmers. And his message was one that I have been implicitly saying throughout this course. If you want to get real pleasure from food, you have to eat responsibly. To him, that meant knowing where your food comes from, knowing what's involved in the production, becoming active consumers rather than passive ones who really never give any thought to the consequences of what they eat. He implored people first to grow food themselves, learn to cook for themselves, deal directly with the people who grow food whenever possible, and know which are the best farming practices. So I think Wendell Berry drew attention not just to the food, but ultimately to connecting it with farms, that those things are really inextricably bound. Just as the counterculture was promoting its own ideal way of eating, at the same time there grew in this country a vibrant new interest in cooking. And at first it was French cooking that enthralled especially middle-class Americans, not the sort of fancy haute cuisine that we saw in the great restaurant kitchens of the 19th century, that, of course, takes hours and hours of prep work, but a kind of rustic and simple French cuisine that is more based on the countryside. More than any other individual, it was Julia Child in her first cookbook, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, and then on TV from the 1960s until her death in 2004, she taught people basic cooking techniques that gave them the kind of confidence to prepare good, honest meals from scratch. It was French food, but definitely not haute cuisine. There were also a handful of others, Craig Claiborne, James Beard in their syndicated newspaper columns and cookbooks. I also remember very fondly Graham Kerr. Remember The Galloping Gourmet? There were also cooking magazines like Gourmet, started in 1941, Bon Appetit started in 1956. Cooking and entertaining became something sophisticated, a leisure activity, and something to enjoy rather than a kind of household drudgery. And the interest in cooking from scratch was a direct affront to mass-produced food. There was also a renewed interest in eating out well, and really at every price level. And restaurants began to be consistently rated. You'd find these 1 to 5 scales and guides like Mobiles, which was started in 1958, or the AAA, you know, the American Automobile Association from 1963. So people could actually go out and find these new restaurants and try them and see the ratings. Increased travel also encouraged people to open their eyes to all the regional cuisines of the U.S. Suddenly people were interested in Creole cooking, and that's long before Cajun, in fact. and Southern barbecue and Boston clam bakes and chowders and Southwest cooking and soul food. And in fact, this is the era when California cuisine became its own unique thing. So there was a flood of cookbooks and TV shows hitting the market. And in the 1970s, especially, there was a new interest in ethnic cuisines. And I think it has something to do with gaining a political voice and equal rights and valuing one's own ethnicity and culture rather than just assimilating into the mainstream white culture and its food ways. American people, on the whole, began cooking things and trying things they would never have dreamed of eating in previous decades. And not just spaghetti and meatballs or chili con carne, but now Indian food, Japanese food, Sichuan, Moroccan, Thai, all sorts of exotic new cuisines came into fashion. For those who wanted to try cooking these cuisines, for the most part, they require fresh ingredients. So it's not like using a pre-made curry powder or a chili powder, but people wanted to be more authentic by using a real garam masala mix and mixing it up, grinding it fresh, or using fresh chilies, things like that. In other words, in an effort to be authentic and prepare these dishes as close as possible to the way they're made in restaurants or even abroad, people were forced to discover new fresh ingredients like cilantro or kaffir lime leaves or nopalitos or bok choy or fresh coconut, plantains, guava. There was even one particular distributor, Frida Kaplan, who began to import exotic fruits as early as 1962. In fact, she practically single-handedly introduced kiwis to this country. And in fact, she named them too. You know, it's kiwi, not the bird, it's the fruit. And also feijoa, cherimoya, carambola, which is those star fruits, horned melons, which is a kiwano from New Zealand, passion fruits. And I would say there was an interest then in what I would call designer vegetables, little baby vegetables, tiny carrots and snow peas and baby zucchini and mosh salad greens. But the important part is that a range of fresh foods familiar to most Americans rose exponentially, thanks in part to people's interest in these ethnic foods and authenticity. Related to these developments was a campaign for real beer and the emergence of microbreweries. People came to realize that mass-produced beer was lacking in character and bore little relation to those that they began to be imported from Europe, the ones with deep malty notes and bracing hop flavors and yeasty overtones and actually local flavor. And if you remember, the U.S., before Prohibition, had many, many local breweries, but afterwards, only the really large ones were able to start up after the Depression. So, but when these microbreweries started finally popping up, people began to realize the subtle differences among different types of beer and ale and the depth of character you could have. And some of these local breweries bottled their own beers, New Amsterdam, Brooklyn Brewery in New York, dozens in Oregon and Washington, like Gordon Biersch and Pyramid. In California, you had Sierra Nevada and Anchor. And at first, they didn't really market these things or distribute them very far. So it remained fresh and attuned to local preferences. But all of that came to change when huge profits began looming on the horizon. And exactly as with health food, some companies either changed their product so it could be mass-produced, Sierra Nevada, or they rented out space in larger breweries so they could increase their scale. That happened to Pete's Wicked. And either way, there were no longer funky, local, temperamental beers. For that, you had to really go to a local brew pub. Moreover, the huge brewers started selling their own cheap imitations. It's usually just beer colored with brown syrup. And you know, today, practically every major brewery has its own, let's call them mock microbrew label, you know, and they very skillfully advertise these to confuse consumers into thinking that it's real, and they give them, you know, dopey names. But a parallel development, analogous to what happened with beer, also took off in the world of cheese making. And in reaction to the mass-produced, rubbery, pasteurized processed cheese food, which is really only 51% cheese ingredients and oil and other stabilizers, a few small dairies began experimenting with new kinds of cheese. For example, they started with goat cheese. There's Coach Farm in New York. There's Laura Chanel Chev in California. And that happens because it's easy to make. It's comparatively inexpensive to keep goats. And it's something Kraft never made because the cheese really does have to be fresh and young. And even though these producers were required by law to pasteurize their cheese, they still did a decent job. You know, they raised their own flocks. They followed traditional protocols as much as they could. And soon, all sorts of other artisanal cheesemakers started popping up, making excellent blue cheese like Humboldt Fog or Point Reyes Farmstead Blue or Maytag Dairy Farms and aged cheddars. They started proliferating all over the country. So today, the U.S. can actually boast a very serious indigenous artisanal cheese culture. Not surprisingly, the big companies and even the dairy boards that have a lot of money were able to capitalize on this interest too. And nationwide, they lobbied to have a little sticker that said real put on anything that actually qualified as cheese. And which I guess is okay because now people know that cheese spread and cheese products aren't cheese. But the California Milk Advisory Board also launched an enormous campaign to compete with the Wisconsin giants. Remember, you know, the Happy Cows, that's part of all that. And these cooperatives essentially forced their suppliers to contribute to these advertising schemes. And then the cheese campaign labels ultimately, I think they confuse consumers because they can't distinguish the artisanal stuff from the industrial. So the artisanal still hold just a small proportion of the market. They remain expensive luxury items. They're sometimes hard to find. I'm hoping that will change, perhaps someday. One interesting idea to consider in all these situations is a kind of DOC system for labeling the origin of foods. The one like they use in Italy. That's a Denominazione di Origine Controllata. And it's a label that actually it's used everywhere in Europe. But first they used it on wine to assure that it comes from a particular terroir. But now it's also used on cheeses, on some species of fruit, on breast bleu chickens, on all sorts of traditional ingredients. So that the name champagne, for example, can only be used on wine made using certain techniques from that particular region, using grapes grown there, or a label to distinguish Roquefort from other generic blue cheeses. So basically, the label tells you that the Camembert or the Parmigiano Reggiano is the real thing made by local people with local ingredients. But in the United States, there are no such laws, and anything can pretty much parade under any territorial name it wants. The only labeling we have which passed legislation after a very long and bitter battle is for organic produce. And the difficulty with legislation was in defining exactly what organic means. A few years ago, the USDA was considering allowing irradiated food and genetically modified food and crops irrigated with sewage sludge to be labeled organic. And it was a few big corporations that lobbied to get that definition watered down. It failed, thankfully. But until recently, there really was no legal definition of organic for the whole country, and you were not even allowed to put such a thing on a label. But even the laws that have been passed, I think they're still a little confusing. You know, organic has become just another way to market products or a way to sell food. Parallel to these developments is a movement called Slow Food, founded in 1989 by the Italian Carlo Petrini, in reaction to the opening of a McDonald's at the foot of the Spanish Steps in Rome. It's actually a very nice McDonald's, but that was the prompting of it. It began largely as a gastronomic movement to get people to slow down, enjoy the pleasures of the table in good company, and also keep alive regional traditions in the face of globalization. By 1996, they had founded a journal and started a project called the Ark of Taste, which was designed to rescue traditional species of plants and animals that were in danger of extinction. And in 2004, they started a big Terra Madre conference that brings together small-scale producers from around the world in an effort to save them. More recently, they've begun to promote fair trade practices and environmental stewardship. But let me read to you a little of the original Slow Food Manifesto. It has a really nice historical ring to it. Our century, which began and has developed under the insignia of industrial civilization, first invented the machine and then took it as its life model. We are enslaved by speed and have all succumbed to the same insidious virus, fast life, which disrupts our habits, pervades the privacy of our homes, and forces us to eat fast food. A firm defense of quiet material pleasure is the only way to oppose the universal folly of fast life. Let us rediscover the flavors and savors of regional cooking and banish the degrading effects of fast food. And it goes on, but you get the picture. A related and more recent movement is sometimes called locavorism. The idea is that you can source food within a certain mile radius, maybe 100 miles, depending on where you live, and that would cut down the cost of transporting food. You'd get fresher food, and not just vegetables, but meat, dairy, and more recently, even fish is included. Going local would mean returning to greater seasonality, of course, as most humans have managed through history, and it might mean eating less of some of those foods that won't grow in some regions, coffee, chocolate, citrus. Advocates say that it's a small price to pay if people can once again become stewards of the land, who understand directly the consequences of the foods they consumed because it's being grown right in their backyard. Another encouraging development is the growth of farmers' markets. And not only do you get human contact with producers, but it puts the profits directly in the hands of the person growing the food. You don't have to pay distributors and processors and cooperatives that spend a fortune on advertising, let alone the dozens of middlemen and grocers and companies that make all this wasteful packaging. Buying from a farmer takes the food right from the soil, puts it in the consumer's hands, which seems the most likely way small farmers will survive. And the only way consumers will have some control over what they buy. They will necessarily consume the freshest and most flavorful products. And you really can't sell bad produce on a local level. You know, things like mushy apples or dried out oranges or sour grapes or flavorless tomatoes or things that are picked green and gassed like tomatoes. Only a huge grocery chain can sell stuff like that. Farmers encourage you to taste their produce and see the difference for yourself. And the number of farmers markets has grown dramatically. The National Farmers Market Directory says that there has been an increase from 1,755 markets in 1994 to 7,175 markets in 2011. That's a 400% increase in less than two decades. And many of them serve cities and operate in low-income districts, or places where there are food deserts and they take food stamps or they participate in food programs like WIC, which is Women, Infants, and Children. And that seems the best way to get fresh produce to people who statistically eat the least in this country. Community-supported agriculture is another rapidly growing movement. Delivers food, whatever happens to be grown, directly from the farm. Also urban farming on abandoned lots, community gardens, school gardens, all of these are changing the way many people get their food. But I do want to give equal coverage to the scientific side of our food supply. Not only genetically modified food, but other technologies, including those that have influenced gastronomy. So in the next lecture, we will take a historical look at current food science, both the advances and the challenges we face today.
Thanks for listening to episode 34 of Food, A Cultural Culinary History. Just a reminder, if you're enjoying this podcast and want more of the same, you can find hundreds of audio courses on all sorts of topics, all taught by brilliant professors like Ken Albala, at thegreatcoursesplus.com/podcasts, featuring in-depth courses on subjects ranging from history, science, yoga, genealogy, music appreciation, landscape photography, and a whole lot more. At The Great Courses Plus, you can learn everything about anything.